The reading of God's Word from the book of Numbers, Numbers the 22nd chapter, begin reading with verse 7. The elders of Moab and Midian left Balak, taking with them the fee for divination, and when they came to Balaam, they told Balaam what Balak had said. And Balaam said to them, "Spend the night here, and I'll bring you back the answer that the Lord gives me." So the Moabite princes stayed with him, and God came to Balaam and asked, "Who are these men with you?" And Balaam said to God, "Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab, sent me this message: a people that has come out of Egypt covers the face of the land. Now come and put a curse on them for me. Perhaps then I will be able to fight them and drive them away." But God said to Balaam, "Do not go with them. You must not put a curse on those people because they are blessed." They are blessed. May God add His blessing to this, the reading of His Word. One of the great privileges I have as a pastor is that I have the opportunity to interact with people from every conceivable walk of life, and I am able to learn more about people, to learn about their hearts, to know something about how they apply their hearts to the work that they are called to do. And at times, quite frankly, I am surprised at what I discover about people and how all of my preconceptions were entirely wrong. For example, in a church that I served in the past, there was a member of the church who was a retired state trooper, retired, to be technical, highway patrolman. That's what he was called when he was active in law enforcement. Now, I don't know about you, but I had always assumed that state troopers were a tad, how shall I put it, hard-boiled, gruff, crusty. I came to discover that this gentleman was one of the most congenial people I have ever met. And as I talked with him about his work, about his experience, I came to discover that, in fact, he saw his work as a chance to bear witness to his faith and to assist people in times of distress. And of course, all I had ever thought was that state troopers live to stop speeders. And since I had the opportunity, I could not help but ask the question, "Well, I know a part of your work involves stopping people who are going too fast on the interstates. Just out of curiosity, what is the number one excuse people have given you when you have pulled them over to write them a ticket?" He said, "Hands down." I mean, it was an immediate response, almost a reaction. "Hands down," he said, "the number one excuse that people gave me when I pulled them over for speeding, they always said, 'I was just going with the flow. I was just keeping up with traffic.' In other words, if I was speeding, everybody else was speeding. I was just going with the flow." And I thought to myself, well, there goes the excuse that I was going to use. I'm going to have to come up with another one. But isn't that just like us? human beings, when we find that we have violated a law, an expectation, a commandment, that we look around, that's our first response, is to look around and to notice the wrongdoing that other people also commit, and if there's anything that is similar to what we have just done that in our heart of hearts we know was not the right thing to do, we say to ourselves, well, I was just going with the flow, as if somehow going with the flow justifies everything that we're about, whether what we're about is right or whether it is wrong. If we're going with the flow, seems like that makes it good. When we look at our lives, we recognize that influence is a powerful thing. What others around us do has a strong bearing on our own behavior. So that if we're around good influences, it stands to reason that those good influences have a way of nudging us in helpful and healthy directions. If, on the other hand, we're around people who are not so good in their influence, those people have a way of dragging us down. And this is not something that people on the younger end of the demographic scale struggle with, what we know as peer pressure. It's something that everyone has to contend with, regardless of his or her age. I love the story of the woman who was celebrating her 102nd birthday. And whenever a person reaches that kind of milestone, word gets out, there's always a camera crew that comes and does a little segment for the 10 o'clock news. And so sure enough, the word got out, the camera crew came, and there was a reporter. And so you've got to get a comment from the 102-year-old saint. And so when asked the question, what's the best thing? What is the best thing about being 102 years of age? The reporter was shocked when the dear woman answered, no peer pressure. There aren't many people that live that long in life. Maybe you reach a stage where you no longer have to keep up with the Joneses, where you don't have to worry about people influencing you in unhealthy, unholy ways. But because not many of us can anticipate, at least as the actuarial tables tell us, to live that long in life, in the meantime, what we must learn to do is to ensure that the influences that we allow in our lives are people who will help us, who will encourage us, who will support us, who will direct us in the right path. And as people of faith, it stands to reason that we need to have people in our lives that will remind us and model for us the importance of aligning our lives with the sovereign purposes of God. Which is one of the lessons that we find in the text this morning from the book of Numbers. Having people in your life who will influence you in godly directions. The book of Numbers is right up there with the book of Leviticus as one of the books of the Bible that we don't usually read, because if we have preconceptions about other people and their professions, we also carry even weightier preconceptions on books of the Bible that have names that may not seem to carry much relevance to us. The book of Numbers, well, it's not one of my favorite books of the Bible because it's got genealogies and there's a lot of census information, and that's not all that's in the book of Numbers. In fact, our Jewish friends do not call this book of the Torah the book of Numbers. They call it In the Wilderness, which are the first words of what we call the book of Numbers, and is quite frankly a more accurate description of the content of this book in the Bible. It recounts the story of the children of Israel as they're making their way from Sinai eastward toward Canaan, the promised land. And it helps us to understand all of the challenges that they faced in the wilderness, the battles that had to be fought, the lessons that had to be learned. In this text that is before us this morning, Balak, who is the king of Moab. Moab was one of the nations through which Israel had to travel on her way to Canaan, the promised land. What we forget when we think about the sojourn of God's people through the wilderness, we forget that it wasn't as if they were traveling through uninhabited territory. There were people who lived every inch of the way. And not all of those people were happy about the children of Israel marching through their homeland. So Israel was attacked on many occasions. There were many battles that had to be fought. Prior to this text, God has given Israel a great victory over the Amorite nation. Balak is the king of Moab. He knows what the people, the nation of Israel, have done to the Amorites. He fears the same thing for his people, for his nation, for his rule. And so he decides that he needs to come up with a plan. And his plan is to go to other Midianite rulers, Midianite princes, and to have them join him in an alliance. And they'll pull their money together. It always goes back to the money, doesn't it? And they send off to Mesopotamia on the other side of the Euphrates River for a sorcerer by the name of Balaam. And Balak and the Midianite princes ask Balaam to come in their direction, to come to Moab, and to place a curse on the nation of Israel, on this people that are making their way through the land of Moab. And so Balaam is in Mesopotamia. He's a foreigner, but he's heard enough about Israel's God that he tells the messengers, let me pray about this and ask God what I should do. And when Balaam goes before God in prayer. God asks this most pressing question to Balaam, the Mesopotamian sorcerer. Who are these men? These Midianite princes that have come to seek your help and to seek your counsel. Who are these men? Now, by now in this series, you've come to understand that when God asks somebody a question, it's not because God is ignorant or uninformed or unaware of the situation or the circumstances. In this case, it's not because God doesn't know the identity of those men. God instead wants Balaam to know that these men are not to be listened to. They're not good influences. They don't have the interest, the best interest of God's people at their heart. They're concerned about their own needs and their own agendas. And so God says to Balaam, at this point in the story, these people want you to go and curse my people. Don't you do it, because my people are people whom I have promised to forever bless. They are making their way to the land that I have told them that they will have, and there's not anything or anyone who will ever stand in their way. Don't curse them, because they are blessed. That's a great story. So, what is it trying to tell us? As with many stories in the Bible, it always is helpful if we pay attention to the context of a given story, of a given text, to see the action that is happening both before a story and what happens after a story. In the 13th chapter of the book of Numbers, there's a story, precedes this one, where the people of Israel decide that might be a good thing to send out some spies to check out this promised land. I mean, they've been fighting ever since they left the Sinai. Chances are they're going to have to fight once they get into the land of promise. And so Moses selects 12 spies. This is in Numbers, the 13th chapter. One from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sends them over into Canaan. They spy out the land. They come back. And 10 of the 12 spies say, the land is fantastic. It is indeed flowing with milk and honey. But let me tell you, these 10 spies said, the people over there are giants, and we're like grasshoppers, and we don't stand a chance. 10 of the 12. That's a super, super duper majority. There are two spies. One is Joshua, who will succeed Moses. The other is Caleb. And they offer the super duper minority report. Two of the 12. Yes, it is a fantastic land. And yes, the people appear to be far stronger than we. But the two spies said, if God has promised to give us the land, God will give us the land. And the people went with the majority. And the majority influenced them to reject the blessing that God had in store for them to know. And if you read on in the 13th chapter, God is ready to wash his hands of the people, and Moses has to intercede, pray on their behalf, and God forgives them. But God says, well, let me tell you, the people that failed to believe me will never enter the land of promise. And they didn't. And they didn't. They did not set foot into Canaan. They died on the other side of the Jordan. That's the story that occurs before this story. You move a little farther into the 25th chapter of the book of Numbers, and there's the incident at Baal Peor. The children of Israel just right there. I mean, they can see Canaan from the Moab side of the Jordan. And Canaanites live in the land where they are, and certain men are enticed to cavort with the Canaanite women and to engage in Canaanite fertility practices. And it is an egregious sin in the sight of God. And one of the Israelites even brings a Midianite woman into the Israelite camp. Purity is a big thing for the Israelites. It's what the book of Leviticus, if you take the time to read it, is all about. You must be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. And it doesn't get any worse than that. In the book of Numbers, to show you how bad it is, even names the Israelite and the Midianite woman. So when the name is specified, it's a way of saying, don't ever make this mistake again. So Moses has to make a difficult decision. And long story short, all of the men who engaged in relations with the Canaanite women were not able to enter into the land of promise. They were influenced to go in ways that were contrary to the purpose of God. Those two stories, bracket this one. This story is God's way of saying, hey, listen, people. If a foreigner, a Mesopotamian sorcerer, listens to me and doesn't do anything but what I tell him to do, waits for me to give him guidance and direction, and rejects the faithless influences of these Midianite priests, how much more steadfast in your obedience should you, my people, be? It's a story that reminds us of the importance of having good influences in our lives and rejecting those that would move us away from God's purposes. I believe with all my heart that Jesus had these stories on his heart. When in beginning his ministry, he was tempted in the wilderness by Satan. The wilderness is not only a place of temptation, the wilderness is also a place of revelation. Jesus tempted by Satan to turn these stones into bread after he had fasted for so long, 40 days and 40 nights. Jesus says, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth from the mouth of the Father. You listen to God and no one else. I think these stories were on Jesus' heart. When it came time to prepare for Calvary, and Jesus gathered his disciples around at Caesarea Philippi, and told them that they were going to Jerusalem, and there the Son of Man would be rejected, arrested, crucified. And it was Simon Peter who said, oh, no, the same Simon Peter had just made the confession when Jesus asked, "Who do people say that I am?" And Simon said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Now, the next breath out of his mouth, "No, no, God forbid that anything like that should ever happen to you." Jesus says to Simon, who had just confessed faith in him, Jesus lauded Simon's faith. "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. God's shown you that. You didn't get that from men." Now, Jesus says to Simon, "Get thee behind me, Satan. For what you've just said is not God. What you've just said comes from men." On both cases, Jesus learned to reject influences that would steer him away from the purposes of God. And that is why Jesus, as Paul says in his letter to the Philippians, though being equal to God, did not count equality with God something to be grasped, but he emptied himself, took upon himself the form of a servant, became obedient to God unto death, even death on the cross. This story in the good news of Jesus Christ, the story of our salvation, bids us to choose God's word over all of the other words, particularly those that would steer us away from God's purposes. Bids us to learn to bring people into our lives who will bless us and help us and remind us that God has a plan for us to experience. He has blessing for us to know. He has abundant life for us to discover each and every day through our faith in Jesus Christ, and not to buy in or give our hearts to anything that would take us anyplace else. Do you have those kinds of influences in your life? Or are there people you have allowed in your life that entice you to move in another direction, away from God? When I was in college, I was in the Baptist Student Union Choir. I couldn't sing a note, or couldn't sing a note, probably is accurate. I could not read a note of music. Even to this day, I can't read music. If there's just a melody line, I can sing the melody line. But, you know, you're in a choir, you got to learn parts. You got to learn harmony. I couldn't read a note of music. So what was I going to do? I decided to sit next to two music majors. Two music majors who could read music. And I would position myself between those music majors, and I would just listen to how they sang the part that I had been told I would sing. And if I allowed those music majors to influence my singing, I discovered I wouldn't embarrass the choir. I wouldn't ruin the performance. There are people that you can allow into your life that will make your soul sounds so jarring, and your life to be totally out of tune. Or there are people that you can invite into your life who will influence you in a direction toward God. Which will it be? Kelly, this is of God that you sang, "I am bound for the promised land." I had no idea what you were singing this morning. Hadn't seen the bulletin when I had written the sermon, and actually didn't notice it until this morning what the anthem was, thinking about the pastoral prayer and how can I find some way to connect with the anthem and other music in our worship this morning. This week, earlier in the week, I was moved to consider that great hymn that is not in the hymnal. We're going to have to speak to them. If they have left out "Have Faith in God," and "I Am Bound for the Promised Land," it's written by Samuel Stennett, an English Baptist minister, How can that hymn not be in the Baptist hymnal? And what I love about the hymn is it's got an attitude. It's a bit subversive. I'm not going with the flow. I have chosen not to go with the flow because the flow is moving in this direction. I'm headed in God's direction. I am bound for the promised land. I've got my sights set on Canaan. And is there anybody that will come and go with me and journey toward the promised land that God has for us to know? And at Mountain Brook Baptist Church, that's how we're doing church, and that's how we're living faith. We're not interested in going with the flow. We're going as God directs. We're moving in the direction that God has for us to go in. We're anticipating the favor that will come to us all along the way. We have Jesus in the lead, the author and the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising its shame. There's not anything or anyone that can separate us from God's love. There's nothing that can stand in the way. So as a church, we say, who will go? Who will go with us to the place where we will together be forever blessed? Will you?